welcome to Take Two. I'm Rhianna Dillon and I'm joined by Anna Bogutskaya. How are you doing?
I'm excellent and in excellent company.
Thank you so much. I, as ever, had a lovely time recording Take One. I always feel like we get quite giddy.
Yes. I mean, there was a very giddy atmosphere already when we came into the studio.
Yes.
And then we get, because we ended on Joyride, which is such a fun movie that we both watched, but did not watch together, which frankly, I'm kind of disappointed in.
I do feel like we do not see enough films together, that we end up talking about these films together.
It's very true.
So let's try and make that a thing of the past. Can you talk us through what we're going to be mentioning in Take Two, please?
So we've got two more reviews to come, the documentary Kokomo City and Paris Memories, the new film by French filmmaker Alice Winocur.
Fabulous. Let's start with Kokomo City. We've got a clip and then we'll go into the depths of this incredible movie.
So like this person is transgender. I know that they got a past. I know that at one point in time, they was another gender, okay? Now I have, like, within this mindset, if I'm going to start a relationship with this person, I have to basically take in, I have to accept that. Now, I think acceptance is a lot of the problem too. I think acceptance of they've overcome whatever it is for them. Their acceptance is not at the same level that the trans person's is, obviously, because they've made that jump.
Yeah, they already
jumped. The other person, no matter how attracted to it they may be, no matter what, they in their mind, they ain't make that jump yet.
Yeah.
So because they ain't make that jump, they're not gonna. They ain't gonna.
So that was a clip from Kokomo City, which is the feature-length and documentary debut by former music producer turned filmmaker Dee Smith. And I knew very little about this film except that it was quite acclaimed when it screened at the Sundance Film Festival in January. And I went into it and was absolutely bowled over by the sheer stylishness of it. It's a very stark black and white documentary about the experiences of black trans women, very specifically focusing on four characters, on four women who are also sex workers. Daniela Carter, Coco Dadol, Leah Mitchell, and Dominique Silver, all of them living either in Atlanta or New York City. Now, it starts off with a really inventive, very fun story being told by one of the women about a potentially dangerous and finally hilarious encounter with a client.
Yeah.
And from that moment on, I knew that this was not going to be another Talking Heads documentary about trans experiences or even the experiences of trans sex workers. Kokomo City is not interested in just the darkness and the dangers, very real dangers, very real perils, and very real marginalization that trans women, particularly trans women, and particularly black trans sex workers face on a daily basis. This film really takes these women, their life experiences, both the highs and the lows, the joys and the fun stories, and the darkness that exists in their everyday life, and the treatment that they've received from people in their life as well as their clients. And it also uses not just interviews with the women, but also with some of their clients, with men in their lives, and the complicated navigation of them being so attractive to straight men, and also being told that by the men themselves that they find their attraction to trans women complicated and kind of contradictory for themselves, without at any point being preachy at all. The film really does illustrate this messiness, and it is also incredibly stylized. Like I mentioned, it's filmed in very stark black and white, but also the framing of the people, the kind of sometimes really allowing them to breathe, to pose, to feel sexy in front of Dee Smith's camera.
Yes, it's not like sitting down on an awkward chair.
No.
It's like so many documentary Talking Heads that we see.
Exactly. She goes into their houses, into their bedrooms to film them. Into their bathrooms, yes, which makes it feel incredibly close and intimate, and also very safe for these women who very often do not feel safe in their lives. And that, I think, really enhances the experience of watching the film. It is just such a beautiful, it's a beautiful portrait of an experience that is contradictory and complicated, and that very often gets painted with tragedy. And Kokomo City is not interested in that. And I think it's such a wonderful and beautiful kind of calling card for a creative voice that seemingly kind of takes their own life experience and their empathy and love for these women and translates that all into a very inventive, lively, fun to watch and heartfelt film.
I do think that the style, the look of this film is so much of its brilliance because as you keep using the word starkly black and white, mm-hmm. and that's so precise because it is. It's kind of overly bleached, the white. And there's a really powerful scene where I think it's Daniela Carter who is sitting in her bath. Mm-hmm. And I think at times she has her breasts exposed. At times the camera doesn't quite show that, which again is just like a really like natural
shot. It's extremely natural. Of her.
Like as if you're sitting with your best friend in the bathroom, you know, which I have done many times where you're just chatting and you're naked mm-hmm. and there's no sexuality to it. It's just you're comfortable with each other. And to kind of invite us into this very vulnerable space felt like a real privilege. Mm. But again, because the background is so bleached white and she is so, kind of lit as so dark and it's almost like a reverse spotlight, I just thought that was extraordinary. And there are so many stills from this, which you would just go, you want to go and see an exhibition of. This is very much an art film.
Absolutely. The dark, the blacks are so deeply black yeah. and the whites are so bleached, as you say.
Yeah.
But weirdly, and I know it's a very, very sort of, you know, a pointed choice to make something look good if you just turn it into black and white. But sometimes the black and white can be very washed out, very grayish. This really dives into the starkness of that, but it makes the film feel very warm yes. because of how close it is to the woman it's portraying, the spaces which they inhabit, and often kind of this choice to, you know, sort of not really focus or stay still on the person speaking, but move mm-hmm. around them, show their environment, show their body, let their words kind of wash yeah. over you as you're getting in what it feels like to be them in that particular moment. It felt really alive.
Mm. And there's a scene that I think if filmed in color would have looked kind of cheap. And
absolutely.
I think because of the camera lens, but in black and white, like the sort of the lack of sharpness actually works really well. And the smudging edges become wistful rather than clumsy, which mm-hmm. I think it would have been in color. And I mean, apart from the visuals of this, there are moments where they are kind of calling out their own communities, discussing their own communities, where they call out other black people for not being allies, despite African-Americans specifically, that's who they're talking about in their communities, being ostracized themselves. They talk mm-hmm. about them still having a perspective from a white person. Mm. And I found all of that is, you know, it's all stuff that I'm so glad this has a platform. I'm so glad these women have a platform to talk about this. There are women that I think going back to Daniela Carter, I think she gave some just incredible speeches that you belong in the UN. Mm. She's talking about writing a book. She has all of these opportunities and I hope that she's afforded them because she absolutely deserves to be heard. They all do. But her ideas are the things that really make you think and dig deep into your own prejudices mm-hmm. as well. Incredibly powerful film.
Really, really beautiful film. And I'm also really pleased for the director, Dee Smith, mm-hmm. who, you know, and this is sort of background information in the film. She had been a really successful music producer, working with really top talent, Grammy nominated the works. And after she transitioned, she was really, really massively ostracized from the industry and had a really difficult time mm-hmm. getting work. She's spoken about this in multiple interviews mm-hmm. that I've read with her as she's been promoting this film and all the success that it's been garnering and won an award at Sundance. And it's going to be in cinemas here and in the US, obviously. It's just, it's a really powerful testament to kind of you, the creative opportunities that can be afforded to someone who's truly, you know, visionary in that way, that has something to say, that will find the means to say it and can create this environment of warmth and empathy for the people they're filming. It's genuinely, for someone who's not from a filmmaking background, mm-hmm. a really impressive first documentary.
I really hope people take the time to go and see this extraordinary movie. We have an email. Dear Margot and Ryan. Wait, who gets to be Ryan?
I want to be Alan.
Having been on holiday for the past 2 weeks, my family and I missed the opening week of Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. We were therefore keen to catch up with Ethan and Benji when we returned from our merry trip abroad.
And Luther. Never forget Luther.
Oh, Luther.
Been there since film one.
He has. and book tickets to see it tomorrow night. The franchise is one of the few that our household can agree on, so we were looking forward to the first cinema trip as a group in over a year. It therefore came as a disappointment to receive an email from the cinema informing us that the showing had been cancelled because Barbie was too popular. I would be more forgiving of this if the new Mission Impossible film was in its third or fourth week. I understand that the top priority of cinemas, especially the big chains like the one in question, is to make money. But at the time of writing, it has only been out for 11 days. Is this the kind of last-minute cancellation due to low demand, a common occurrence that I have been lucky never to have experienced before? Or is this a rarity? I should clarify that we were refunded, but I still found the change in showings frustrating. Up with Tom Cruise, except the whole Scientology thing. Pretty big thing, too. But yeah. And down with the bigots. All the best, Dan.
I think it is relatively common. You know, I think the Barbenheimer effect and the massive box office success of Barbie specifically does have an impact on this. Mm-hmm. But cinemas need to stay open and their businesses. And if you have a showing or multiple showings that are selling out constantly and one that just isn't moving any tickets, it makes absolute sense to afford another showing to Barbie instead of one that hasn't sold that many.
Sorry.
Nothing against Tom.
Well, I hope you did go and see it, and I hope that all your family loved it as much as you hope they would. Next up, we have Paris Memories. So tell us about this. We'll play a clip, and then you can tell us even more about it.
So this is the new film by writer-director Alice Winokur, which is partially inspired by her own brother's experiences in the aftermath of surviving a terrorist attack in Paris. And in the film, we focus on Mia, who is a translator who struggles to repatch her life after being caught up in a terrorist attack in Paris. So let's hear a clip and then I'll tell you a bit more about it.
Great.
J'écrivais. Enfin, j'avais un stylo plume. J'étais en train d'écrire.
Je sais pas. Peut-être, j'imagine. Ouais.
Qu'est-ce qui s'est passé ensuite?
Ensuite, vous vous êtes levé, vous avez traversé le restaurant. Vous avez dû aller aux toilettes, je crois. Et vous vous souvenez de rien?
Non. C'est des moments qui ont disparu, quoi. Je me rappelle plus. Enfin, je me rappelle plus très bien. J'ai encore des... des images avant l'attaque, des sons, mais à partir du moment où j'ai vu les premiers morts, tout s'est effacé. Je ne me rappelle plus rien.
C'est de la chance.
So that was Mia discussing the trauma around the attack that she experienced.
So in that clip, we're
French, by the way.
It is in fact French. It is a French motion picture made in France. People speak in French.
They're French.
Set in Paris. It's French.
I would be sitting in a corridor somewhere by myself thinking.
I'd be in Shakespeare and Co. just with a pile of books.
That was a little throwback to Take One, FYI. Anyway. But,
yeah, so this film, and we saw in the clip, Virginie Efira and Benoît Magimel trying to essentially piece together what happened. Mm. So Mia is caught in a terrorist attack that happens in a restaurant, and she's one of many people affected, but the film really centers on her essentially trying to grapple and trying to remember what actually happened, trying to piece it together. And the way that she goes about it is kind of trying to go and find and talk to other survivors of the same attack, mm-hmm. see if they remember her, what they remember happening. You know, it's a complicated exploration of the complexities of PTSD. Mm-hmm. Like, what happens when you're not exactly clear on what the trauma was outside of the general, I was caught up in a terrorist attack, mm-hmm. but, and also how does that affect different people? How do different people remember it? Do they get angry? Do they get, you know, depressed? Like, what is the spectrum of emotion that they go through? And Mia is essentially trying to figure out how was she feeling after this? Mm-hmm. You know, there's upheaval in her life and she's, you know, nothing feels exactly right after that happens, even though she kind of leaves the attack relatively physically unscathed. But it's all about essentially the reframing of her own sense of self, her sense of memory, her sense of safety. And also, and this is one of the things that I really responded to, her sense of the city. You know, there's a lot of shots in the film of her wandering around Paris, of her driving around the city on her little moped. There's a lot of shots of the city, but it feels almost alien, really blank. Mm-hmm. And I think this part of her process of sort of retrotting the city and getting back to its rhythm from this sense of this overwhelming sense of numbness that she feels is one of the things that really stood out to me. It's, you know, on the surface for people who are deciding whether to go and see it or not, it's a very straightforward but emotionally complicated movie. And Alice Winokur has done this kind of films that have one central, really big idea that she wants to explore. You know, she's the filmmaker behind such films like Mustang or Disorder, Proxima. Mm-hmm. And this is very much in that fold. It's adult focused, it's emotions focused, and it takes this one big moment and explores the emotional ramifications of it without being too interested in the political side or too interested in the attack itself. We see little bits of it, but what matters here the most is memory and the reconstruction of memory.
It's so interesting about the relationship that she has to the city, because whenever we talk about cities on screen, we kind of talk about them as being another character often. And when we talk about them in that sense, we kind of mean like an old friend, or it's a very comfortable space to be in, or the way it's portrayed is, you know, reflective of how we feel about it. So if you're talking about a city which essentially in her mind may have betrayed her, that, because I'm, you know, of course the majority of people have not themselves gone through a terrorist attack, but perhaps a majority of people have lived in a city which has gone through some sort of, has kind of been,
it changes the city,
an act of terrorism. You know, after 7/7, I think everybody started to look at London very differently.
Well, I remember living in Madrid at the time of the Madrid metro attacks, and that completely changed the sense of safety of the city, and also any individual's relationship with the city and even the underground.
It's fascinating to think about it from that perspective, from the city being actually the one who is doing the betraying and not being the safe space anymore, like a character, but in a very different way. Thank you so much. That was Paris Memories. And now it is time for Pretentious. Moi. Now, you are up one because you got Piggy last week and we played a clip from your review last year. So let's play out another clip. Please cue the tension bed. Okay, rather than reading a review that you've written, I have another clip that we're going to play in. So this is you a while back reviewing a film on this show again. What is the name of this film? Cue the clip.
This film fails for me as a comedy. It tries to do too much action because it's trying to, you know, it's trying to earn its horror chops by adding quite a lot of gore and action into it. And it's just unnecessary, because when you have performers like who is essentially playing the straight man in this, it's Renfield.
Amazing, Anna. Amazing. I was here for this.
Yeah.
This
Did
me.
You remember it?
I didn't even get a chance to think about it because you said it so quickly.
Yes. It was the gore bit. I was like, oh, yeah.
You were talking about Nicholas
Holt and Awkwafina.
Yes. Well, there you go. You're winning.
Pretentious. Moi.
Rien.
Bah oui.
No, that doesn't make sense. Nothing. Never. I don't know. What's never in French?
Jamais,
yeah, I thought so. Yeah, that's what I thought. all right, we have an email. Ahoy, hoy, long-time listener and second-time emergency emailer. I was seemingly the one and only listener who sat through Silent Night a couple of years ago.
I did not.
What was Silent Night?
It was the David Harbour Killer Santa movie.
Oh, yeah, I did not. Your conversation this week about the differing impact that movies can have on you if they reflect events that are taking place in your life reminded me of an event of which my wife still won't let me forget nearly 15 years later. When the orphanage, El Orfanato, El Orfanato came out in 2007, the twofer of a Marc Kermode recommendation and a Guillermo del Toro producing credit made it a must watch. At this point, I should probably mention that at the time, my wife was 6 months pregnant with our second child. I thought the movie was terrific, and from the view of my sofa, just put my wife's silence down to her enjoying the incredibly tense and unsettling atmosphere of what was playing out. When it finished, she disappeared upstairs to bawl her eyes out and then compose herself, coming back down to ask me what on earth possessed me to put a movie like that one on. Mark Kermode said it was good. Traumatized is the word that she uses to this day to describe the experience and the effect it had on her, followed by a poor Simon. Keep up the great work, Mr. Mike. So I have this with Funny Games, Michael Haneke's Funny Games, which, so my husband Mike has been doing, has rewatched both the original and the remake, which is a shot-for-shot remake by Haneke.
In English.
In English. Completely pointless.
Curious.
But I had to watch this at college.
Yeah.
And I remember running out, I can't remember if I've told this on the pod before, but I remember like running out of the classroom and sobbing onto my friend Shane's shoulder because I was so distraught by Funny Games. It really cut me deep. I found it, like Home Invasion anyway is one of my worst subgenres of horror.
Oh, same.
Which is what Mike is concentrating on with his podcast at the moment.
I can't wait to do my own Home Invasion season because it is genuinely my deepest fear.
Why can you not wait to do that then? Surely you'd be like...
I am waiting to do it. I'm just leaving it till last.
I just, but it's so interesting how people kind of have different reactions
to this.
I like
confronting my fears.
Yeah, I do not. I run away from them.
I will chase it.
A friend of ours made his partner watch this on a first date. Funny Games. I just think that is
A red flag.
How have they lasted 10 years, 15 years they've been together. We celebrated their 15-year anniversary in Madrid, in fact. But,
wow.
What? Why?
Wow.
So, I feel like there is... stop showing your partners these really awful films.
I mean, I went on a first date a while back to see... God, what was that? Lords of Chaos.
No.
Yes.
You saw Lords of Chaos?
The first date.
On a first date?
There was no second date.
Did you leave immediately? Did you handshake and leave? We are going to one frame back now, and we're going to be talking about childhood friends. So this is because of Joyride, which is all about childhood friends, the pros and cons of having them. And I mean,
excellent, excellent subgenre of movies.
It is a really good one, actually. I'm really happy with this. And especially because, you know, my childhood friend said some very like explicit things that I thought only she would know about at my wedding. So now like everyone knows about it, which is quite frustrating. And I'm still cross with her. But the joy of having childhood friends is that you get over it, you move on, you forgive. are you still, because obviously you're not in the same country that you grew up in.
No.
So do you still stay in touch with your childhood friends?
Not really.
Must be really tough.
Very
when you move
vaguely. Yeah. No, we do send each other kind of birthday messages and things like that because we were born only a few days apart.
Cute.
But I mean, not in the same country or anything, but we celebrate our birthdays in the same month.
Yep.
But yeah, not really.
Interesting. So childhood friends movies, Paul has said, presume there'll be a lot of love for Stand By Me. This was the first thing that came to mind, like literally the first one that sprung to my mind. So I'll opt for the screen adaptation of Stephen King's other ode to formative childhood friendships, It. 1990,
that's a good shout,
1990 Tim Curry version or 2017 Skarsgård remake, viewer's choice.
Both.
Love that.
I love both.
I love that there's no snobbery with the It.
Of course there would be no snobbery with It.
Good.
That, the 1990 version has actually terrified me for years. I couldn't fully watch it in its entirety until I was 19 because Tim Curry's clown terrified me so much. A childhood friend of mine showed it to me at a sleepover, and as soon as he came onto the screen, I started screaming so loud that they just had to take it out,
oh,
and I had to
goodness.
Be calmed down.
Hannah! Oh, that's so sad.
Sick clowns.
I always used to get Tim Curry muddled up with Jeremy Beadle for some reason. I do not know why. Marie Claire has said, I'm going old school, 1966 old school, The Trouble with Angels. I have not seen this film.
I haven't seen this film either.
I don't know anything about it, but Marie Claire, thank you for bringing it to our attention. Ian Hargreaves has said, I have a few faves, which may give away my age. The Breakfast Club, I rewatched so many times as a teenager. Great shout. And Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Jennifer Grey was brilliant as the sister, infuriated by and admiring of her younger brother. Still quite weird that they went out in real life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, Jennifer Grey's autobiography is certainly an experience.
Oh, my goodness. I've not read it. I'm going to got to. Is it really full of dirty secrets?
I mean, she's a wild one.
Is
but
she?
Also, I mean, I haven't read it. I have, however, listened to the Celebrity Memoir Book Club podcast episode about it.
It's always a podcast. It's a podcast about everything. Yes. Thank you so much, Ian. Yeah, those are good shouts. James Rodriguez has said, time to suggest a bleak alternative with Mean Creek, a Jesus. Haunting and unforgettable tale of revenge gone terribly wrong. James, you're dark. Anna, thoughts?
You know what? Let's get to the last recommendation because I have a few of my own and I am offended to my very core that these movies have not come up from the listeners.
Okay. Sean has said, I pick Edge of 17 because it's one of the only films that I can think of that examines the relatable feeling of two childhood friends making peace with drifting apart as their lives take shape and grow more complicated.
It's a great show.
It's a really good movie.
And actually, I'm going to add to that, a relatively little known British film from, I believe, 1998 called Me Without You with Anna Friel.
Oh my God, you just made my
Michelle
heart.
Williams. Like, it's incredible, isn't it?
A little bit, yeah.
It's an unbelievably great movie, partly about that, of two friends who become bad for each other mm-hmm. and realize that they need to drift apart. It is essentially a portrait of a lifelong toxic friendship. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely gorgeous. And I recommend it at any chance I get. And also, people will always bring up Stand By Me, but in that same era, in 1995, came out a movie which is often very much compared to Stand By Me, but I think is just as good, if not arguably even better. Mm-hmm. And that's Now and Then, Leslie Linka Gator's film, with the most 90s cast of women. You've got Christina Ricci, Thora Birch, Gabby Hoffman, and then as their adult counterparts, you've got Rita Wilson, Demi Moore, Melanie Griffith, Rosie O'Donnell. So it's about the last summer friendship mm-hmm. of these, you know, childhood friends and how they spend this last summer together before they start drifting apart. And obviously, I'm sorry, this is very 90s, but Romy Michelle's high school reunion.
Yes! Oh my God, the post-it lie.
Exactly. The businesswoman special.
So fun.
So Me Without You, Now and Then, and Romy Michelle's High School Reunion, three absolutely excellent movies also, about childhood friends.
It's so interesting that Christina Ricci is now doing Yellow Jackets, yes. where she plays the older version.
Yes.
Having played the younger version in Now and Then.
The Ricci songs. I mean, she never went away, did she?
I was thinking of, I mean, there are like the really obvious, you know, the Harry Potters, etc. Skate Kitchen, I think, is sort of, you know,
that's
undervalued, really sweet indie film. I interviewed the director of that, which was a terrifying experience and not to be repeated, hopefully, ever. But the film.
Were you on skateboards?
No.
No.
Why would I be on a skateboard interviewing someone?
I don't know. Maybe it's a PR stunt. They put you both on skateboards.
Absolutely not. If anyone suggests that to you, do not do it. That is a broken arm waiting to happen. No, I really like that. Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging. Again, we've probably talked about my love for Aaron Taylor-Johnson on this podcast.
I don't think we have. No. And I fear that might not be safe for work.
It's not. You're absolutely right. So let's move on. Thank you so much to all of your suggestions for childhood friends movies. This, again, is like such a great subgenre. Do explore it. And I've written Now and Then on my hand to remind me to watch it this afternoon.
Oh, please tell me what you think. You're going to love it. Honestly, if there's any publishers listening, I will happily write an entire book about Now and Then.
Okay, it is time for Take It or Leave It. You decide. So this week's recommendation is from Barbara. Hi, Barbie. My recommendation for Take It or Leave It is The Orchestra. It's a witty, lighthearted story about certain members of an orchestra and their ambitions and very narcissistic tendencies. It's 10 half-hour episodes, so perfect pre-bedtime viewing, as it definitely won't give you nightmares, but rather allow you to go to bed with a smile. The acting is brilliant, as is the script. For me, definitely take it, as I hope it is for you too. Love the programme. /podcast. Keep up the good work. Barbara, a very long time listener.
Thank you, Barbara, for recommending this show to watch. It is exactly as she says, a very lighthearted, perfect pre-bed viewing. Like I mentioned last week when we talked about Somebody Somewhere, there is a real dearth of sort of 20 to 30 minute mm-hmm. lighthearted comedy series. And this is very much one of them. It is Danish, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken.
It is Danish.
And, you know, it is essentially like The Office, but set in a symphony orchestra. And imagine if the protagonist, instead of being a Tim or a Jim, it's Dwight.
I've seen the first two episodes, and that is such a great description.
Yeah.
What if Dwight was the protagonist?
What if Dwight was a deeply talented and deeply self-involved clarinet player who still lives with his mother, is a hypochondriac, has a very strange mole in his back, and just thinks that he should be the principal clarinet player instead of
Simon.
Anyone else?
It's Simon. He hates Simon. Yes.
It's quite a joyous watch. There's nothing particularly new about it. The setting is quite fun. You know, it's really enjoyable to see kind of really egocentric musicians play off against each other, especially someone like Bo, who's the protagonist, sort of the default protagonist, who is so unaware of the effect that he has on other people, how much he can hurt people with just a throwaway sentence, and how far his own head is up his own ass. it's funny. That's all it needs to be.
But to take your US Office metaphor even further, imagine if Toby from The Office, who in this place, in this, this is called Yeppe, if he is the sort of secondary protagonist and his plight of the whole series is kind of to keep Bo in line and fails miserably, because that's essentially what it is. He's kind of shunned by his wife. He doesn't have any respect from people at work. People are outwardly quite rude to him. And he's just trying to do the best thing he can. He's just trying to be a good Toby. I mean, Yeppe. Yeah. So, I think this is really fun. I don't know if I was so fully invested that I would just go and watch the whole series.
I agree. I really...
It was perhaps too light.
Because it reminded me so much of other shows. It's got the mockumentary approach as well to it.
It's not quite mockumentary,
It's not quite mockumentary, but it uses the same visual language as that. It's a fair, good show, but if you are in need and you've rewatched Parks and Rec and The Office many times over and you just need something a bit fresh, this is solid enough that it'll remind you of other shows that are perhaps have a bit more personality to them. Mm-hmm. And it's not bad by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
I just think perhaps it just doesn't have that much character to it. But it's absolutely a good time.
Thank you so much, Barbara. Good recommendation, and actually one that I would never have found if it hadn't been for you emailing in. So please do send in your suggestions for great stuff that we might have missed, because we might never find them. It's all down to you, the listener. Take it or leave it. You decide. So we have scoured the listings for things that you might otherwise have missed, and indeed things which you should absolutely miss this weekend. It's called Weekend Watch List, Weekend Not List. Great name. Five are great and three you'll hate. Anna is going to pick one of each. These films are all on TV in the UK and, let's be honest, probably available to stream overseas. So first up on the watch list, there's GoldenEye from 1995. Then we have Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone from 2001. The Italian Job, 1969. Good classics in here. Ghostbusters from 1984. And the film that my dad called predictable, The King's Speech. From 2010.
I agree with your dad. If anything, The King's Speech should be on the not list.
So Sean has said GoldenEye, one of the best Bond films with Pierce Brosnan, giving one of the best performances of any Bond. We won't talk about Die Another Day. Not Sean. Faye from Southall has said Ghostbusters. I started a part-time job in a cinema. I was still in school. This was the first big film I saw on duty. Seemed to be there for months. What a cool introduction to your job at a cinema, Ghostbusters. Rom Doodle has said The Italian Job for self-preservation.
I'm so curious about what that means.
Me too.
What do you mean, Rom Doodle?
I don't think Rom Doodle's his real name either.
I hope it is, actually. It's a great name.
Daniel Flynn has said The King's Speech for the scenes between Colin Firth and Geoffrey Rush alone. Two wonderful, understated performances that play off each other perfectly with great dialogue. Understated. Patrick McCauley has said Ghostbusters, but it doesn't have Minis, Michael Caine, or Benny Hill. So it's actually The Italian Job for me. I'd have thought that anything without Benny Hill would have been
a good thing.
Jason Marsden has said the Italian job, the minis, doing things that minis shouldn't do, jumping buildings, crossing dams, jumping steps, driving down steps. Is he thinking about Herbie? Sod the actors, the minis are the best thing in it. And Paola Davies has said, Italian job, don't trust anybody who doesn't love it. Anna, dare I ask your thoughts on the Italian job before we get to your pick of the week?
It's going to be my pick of the week.
Great.
It's the Italian job.
Okay, good for you.
You had me at the minis.
You can watch the Italian job on Film 4 at 4:24 p.m. on Saturday, the 5th of August. That's tomorrow if you've listened as soon as this drops. Time for the not list then. We have Bride Wars from 2009. Hush, that's on the not list. Baywatch from 2020. Absolutely belongs on the not list. And Fast and Furious 7 from 2015.
Where do you stand on the Fast franchise, Rihanna?
I am a pretty big fan of Fast and Furious films.
Good.
Because they do what they say on the tin. They're for
exactly.
A certain audience. They're not trying to pretend to be anything they're not. That's okay. I'm okay with that.
Exactly, which is why I am shocked and appalled that any Fast film has ended up on the not list.
Having said that, I can't actually remember which the
This is the James Wan one. The James Wan film.
Yeah, I know who James Wan
there's
is, but that
cars
help.
And there's family. And I will not have the Fast franchise besmirched in any capacity at any point in time, except Fast 4, which is garbage.
Okay. Strong feelings about the Fast movies. Gtro.
So two options, really.
Okay. Gtro has said, I have a soft spot for Baywatch, and Fast 7 is certainly not the worst in the franchise and is enjoyable. However, Bride Wars is insipid garbage and should be avoided at all costs.
Her Schwartz about Kate Hudson, what did she ever do to you?
Alison has said, I'm pleased to say I don't know, as I haven't seen any of them. Hello to all blue-haired Jason Isaacs and down with new oil fields. Thank you so much for taking the time, Alison, to get in touch. Notable Chook has said, Bride Wars should not be on this list. Someone
Good.
Who loves Bride Wars. And Heather Wallace has said, Fast and Furious is miles ahead, pun intended. Heard better puns, but it's not bad. Of the others, the acting is better, the plot is more convincing, and so are the character motivations. Family.
It's all about family. What have you got against family,
Dylan? So that's
like
a zombie Phil Mitchell then. I'm really sorry.
It will get there eventually.
So what is your pick of the not watch list?
Honestly, I wouldn't pick any of them.
The not list.
But maybe, you know, I feel terrible because I hate disrespecting either Zac Efron or The Rock. But maybe Baywatch.
Yeah, it's interesting. No one has really sort of said a bad word about Baywatch.
I do like Baywatch. It's not a great movie. I mean, but I did enjoy watching it. It's a great hangover movie.
Fantastic. Well, so we need to.
Watch Baywatch.
So I will pick, I can't really remember much about Bride Wars.
They're brides at war.
Yeah, I remember that bit. I remember the tagline. I remember the poster.
Kate Hudson, Anne Hathaway.
Yes.
Dress drama.
But
did you have dress drama at your wedding?
No, I found it in it was like the fourth dress that I tried on and I just, from a secondhand shop and I just bought it. It was very easy.
So not a movie forthcoming about Brianna Dillon, Bride Wars.
It would be a short. Fast and Furious 7, Baywatch, Bride Wars. I would probably still avoid Baywatch because I think there is a reason I have avoided it thus far.
Is it because you hate the sea?
It's because I'm not a fan of the acting often of Zac Efron and The Rock.
Oh, so you just hate beauty.
So I think I would avoid Baywatch. What about you?
I would not avoid any of these films because I enjoy them all.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe...
The one that you would least recommend to others?
Perhaps Bride Wars would be the one that I would least recommend because I think anything with The Rock in it is worth watching. And the entire Fast franchise is a gift to humanity and all of those entries are worth watching except Fast 4, which is trash.
Good to know. Bride Wars, if you want to ignore Anna's advice, is on E4 at 6:15 p.m. on Sunday the 6th of August. Anna, thank you once again for joining me for the
thank
take.
Thank you.
For take two. We're not going to be in take three because we have saved that purely for Mark and Simon, who are broadcasting from the Grand Union Canal. We'll hopefully speak to you and see you and hear from you in the future. But for now, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure to be your super subs for the past fortnight.
It was a pleasure, never a chore. Thank you everyone for listening. And to you, Rhianna Dillon, for being the best host, as always.
Oh, stop it. But thank you.